Hey, you. Yes, you. Listening to the Aggressive Life podcast right now. We need your help to take this show to the next level. One of the ways that you can do that is by leaving a rating and review whenever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Your ratings and reviews go a long way in putting the show in front of new people. So to say thanks, we have something just for you. That would be to say thanks for you actually leaving a review. You can do that and then shoot an email to Dirt with your mailing address and we'll send you a postcard and Aggressive Life sticker. It's all honor system, so leave those reviews, shoot that email, and you'll get something sweet in your mailbox. Let us know at dirt@briantome.com. That's your real
email. My new email address.
Oh, my gosh. That is awesome. dirt@briantome.com. Let's get on with the show. Welcome to the Aggressive Life. You know, we like to say you never know what you're going to get in this podcast. Sometimes someone's interviewing me. Sometimes I'm interviewing somebody else. Sometimes it's a talk that I'm giving. Sometimes we're talking to somebody who you've probably never talked to before. Not just you haven't talked to this person, Dirt, but I bet this topic is one that they've never, ever thought of in their life.
And it's going to be fascinating.
And it's fascinating for me.
Totally.
And that's really all that matters. As long as it's fascinating for
that's
me.
That's right. That's right.
It's going to be unbelievable. You know, we've had Hollywood actors, rock stars, theologians, pastors, outdoor survival experts, explorers, yada, 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 yada. Well, today we're talking to a guy who likes beavers. You sicko. That's not what I'm talking about, Dirt. We're talking today to a USDA beaver trapper from South Carolina who just so happens to be a successful podcaster, author, and keynote speaker. He had me on his podcast a while ago talking about the five marks of a man. And then the podcast ended. And then I just like, what do you do for a living? What's your normal thing? And so he starts on like, oh my gosh, this has been one of my pet hobbies forever, not a hobby of beavers, but I've just found the topic of beavers and dam construction utterly fascinating. And I haven't done as much as I'd like to. That's why I was digging into him. That's why I said, would you please come on the podcast? So Pete Rogers is going to be with us. He has a podcast called Christian Outdoors, and he's got all kind of amazing people who sponsor his podcast. I'm going, my gosh, we need to get on that train. Like, he's got Ruger
man,
guns.
Come on.
No,
like,
no.
That's
not Ruger.
Oh, it's not Ruger?
Taurus.
Sorry, Taurus. Yeah. Are they giving you free guns?
I cannot answer that.
I mean, I got people give me free athletic greens, which is great. I like it. It works. I've got people give me steaks up in the
Flying K Ranch.
Yeah. They're fantastic. But I need to get somebody giving me like motorcycles and guns and stuff. That's anyway. Pete is here to talk to us about beavers and his role in the USDA. We're gonna hear all we can from this manly man. He's actually quickly becoming an actual personal friend of mine. He's an aggressive man living an aggressive life. Welcome to the Aggressive Life, Pete Rogers.
Thank you, Brian. That's a little over the top. I'm not used to that, but I appreciate it very much. It's funny when you were doing all that that opening monologue and you're talking about all these people you've had on the show, you know, and I'm a pastor, I'm a trapper, I'm a podcaster. I was like, well, yep. I cover all those areas. It's been a good ride so far.
Yeah, well, God's doing a good thing in your life, and it's great hearing about it, and love how you're just charting a different course for you and your life, which is basically the aggressive life, right? I mean, you could have just stayed in the USDA beaver lane or just the pastor lane or just the podcaster, but you know, you're figuring out something that works for your life and you're having a good time with it. That's cool. So here's what happened. A recent hunting trip I was on. I was in Idaho and I was driving on one of these dirt roads with a guy who was with me. And I said, oh my gosh, you know what that is? He says, no, what? I said, that is a pond created by a beaver. He said, oh, Oh, really? Okay, it was impressive. Oh, dude, look, here they are. There's four of them right in a row here. Those are not man-made dams. Those are beaver dams. One of God's creatures actually went out and gnawed down trees and gathered sticks and put this thing in here. And this is changing the entire landscape. So before I go on more of what little I know about beavers, tell us, why are beavers so important, or why do they need to be managed? Just give us a beaver life 101.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, because you just hit both sides of it, is that they are very important to the ecosystem when they're not around humans. And what I mean by that is, so I want to talk about both sides of it very briefly. It's one, they create an entirely new ecosystem by building dams. All right. But when they do that in urban and suburban environments, it starts flooding roads. And then people drive through flooded roads and they can get injured or killed or whatever. And they also do tens of millions of dollars here in my home state in South Carolina of damage to trees and shrubs and bushes and things of that nature. South Carolina, one of our main industries here is pine trees. We grow trees to create lumber and paper and things of that nature. And when you get a pine plantation and a beaver gets in there, you can wreak havoc pretty quickly. And they don't have a natural predator down here in the South. They just don't. And really? A beaver can live 20 plus years in the wild. So you got an animal that's 30, 40, 50 pounds, 60 pounds. They can eat a lot of wood. And that is what they eat, by the way. They eat the cambium layer of the tree. The wood, what's also known as the inner bark, that's what they eat. So that's why when you see the beaver dam that you described, and I'll get to how they build them in a minute, none of the sticks have bark on them because they've eaten them.
For food, their own personal food.
Yeah. And then they recycle. They take the stick that they just ate the bark off of and put it in their beaver dam. Huh. And help to create the dam. And the reason they create dams is because they're naturally aquatic animals. They don't walk really well. They have really funny feet. Their front legs are only 2 inches long. And so they are made by God to swim. And if there is no environment for them to swim, they create one. Hmm. They're hardwired to build dams. And so they create the dam to create an environment for them to live in, because they are aquatic mammals. And as the dam gets bigger, the water spreads, and they're still hardwired. When they see water moving, they have to make it. So they never stop building their dams the whole time they're alive. They will continue to add and expand and add and expand and add and expand. And in the northern hemisphere, or the northern parts of North America specifically, you know, these lakes and ponds freeze over, right? So they can't get to the surface. So they work really hard to build these dams, and then they will also be storing food at the bottom of the pond so that when it freezes and they can't get out, they can still get to a food source. So they'll have these little food caches all over their ponds where they can come out of their lodge. That's what their living quarters is called, a beaver lodge.
Right.
They'll come out of their lodge and go down there and get the food, bring it back into the lodge and eat it.
Well, if it freezes over, how are they getting oxygen?
In their lodge, they have air vents.
In their lodge? These creatures, they're unbelievable.
It really is. It really is. I've been doing this a long time. I've been a professional beaver trapper for 15 years now, almost 15 years with the USDA, and I trapped personally way before that. But I have caught an enormous number of beavers and have torn out thousands of dams, and I am constantly amazed at how good they are at what they do. I mean, they can really build some really strong dams.
My first exposure hands-on to a beaver dam was on a bike trip in Colorado, and the water was too high. If the water's too high on a creek crossing, your engine, you have air intake, and an engine needs three things to fire. It needs oxygen, spark, and fuel. So you have an air intake that sucks air into the engine, right? And if it's water's too high, you suck water into your engine and you waterlock it. So someone did that going over, and it was actually me. Waterlocked it. Me and my son both waterlocked our engine. So then we had four other guys who now are tearing apart the engines to blow the water out and all that stuff. We said, okay, before these other guys come over, we need to lessen this water. And it was high because a beaver dam had gone on this water and jacked up the height of it. So we thought, no problem. For these other guys coming across, we're just going to go over here and we're going to tear out these sticks and lower the water level and all be good. Oh no! We may as well have had a jackhammer trying to take out concrete. None of us could. We couldn't budge that dam. We could maybe find one stick here or there to pull out, but they were woven together so we could not. We would have been there all day, and maybe six grown men. If we spent all day, we might have been able to lower the water like 2 inches. It was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very good at it. They really are. And I've my son has the same job in the neighboring county now. He started just a few months ago, and I've been training him on all this stuff in the USDA way. And one of the things I've told him is you can tell after you've torn out a bunch of dams about how big the beavers are that build the dam. Because it's a young beaver, it's not constructed very well. Huh. If it's an older beaver, it's constructed very well.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And one of the key things is if you or I wanted to dam up a creek, we're going to lay stuff perpendicular to the creek to try to stop it, right? That's what we do. We're going to lay a log perpendicular to it so that it flows into it and tries to. A beaver does the exact opposite. They lay their sticks with the flow of the creek.
Huh.
And so they'll take a sapling that's 10 feet tall. They'll chew it off at the bottom, eat it, and then they take what's left and they put the trunk downstream in the top of the tree where they want their dam to go, and they pack mud around all the little stem, all the small part of the tree. And they keep doing that and doing that. And what happens when the pressure is against the dam, those long sticks going downstream work as a cantilever to hold the dam in place.
Hmm.
It's very ingenious. It really is.
How do they do that? Like, I'm just thinking, how do they start the dam? Because you just told me how you start the dam, but how do they keep the first few sticks from just blowing away?
Well, if the river's flowing too fast, they can't.
Okay.
They All right. can't.
Got it.
It has to be a slower stream. And they'll just literally start with a... I know the listeners can't see this what I'm doing here, but they'll start with almost a V in the bottom, and they will make the V wider. In other words, they're going up and across at the same time, and they just lay sticks on, and as they lay it, with the part we don't recognize because all we see is the sticks, is they're pushing mud up.
Wow.
And they'll use grass. They'll use bulrushes if those are there. I was showing my son of the day one of the most impossible dams to dig out is one that's in a cornfield where they're using corn stalks and husk and kudzu vines and whatever and packed in mud. And it is like concrete. I mean, you can swing your rake as hard as you want to, and it just almost bounces off of it. It's so hard.
Wow. Yeah,
those are difficult.
That's really interesting that you said that the younger beavers aren't as good as the older beavers. That's fascinating. Do the younger beavers, are they getting mentored by the older beavers, or the younger beavers finally realize, well, the way I'm doing it right now is not working, so I should just try to innovate? How do they advance in their skills?
I think it's both, because in the beaver family unit, so a mama beaver comes in season in about October, and she'll get bred, and she'll have the babies about March. Right. And those babies will stay with her for a year and a half. Okay. So they are adults by the time that she kicks them out of the nest or out of the lodge. But before she can come in season again, she has to remove them. And you see that all in the animal kingdom. In order for the mother to come back into heat or back into season, that she has to stop nursing and get rid of the younger ones for it to happen just the way God made it. So, and that usually happens in October down here in the South. And when that happens, these year and a half olds are going to follow streams. It's called dispersal. They're going to disperse, and they're going to go looking for places to set up housekeeping. And so what happens is that the young males are going to go, and they're going to build a dam to try to recruit a female. And they have only got 1 year's of experience watching mom and pop build the dam. Hmm. And I think what they're doing through all the years doing this is they're building the dam, and they see that when it rains a little bit, it blows it out. So they start making some adjustments, until you see when you get a beaver that's 40 pounds or so, which is a very grown beaver, that these dams are built very, very well. And I've told my son, I said, you watch at this place right here, we're going to catch a beaver that's about 15, 20 pounds. It's a year and a half old. It's not very, very knowledgeable because of the way the dam's built. And at another place, I said, these are going to be really big beavers that we catch here because look how this dam's built. It's built so well. And they can do it incredibly fast, Brian. It's amazing. You know, the old saying, busy as a beaver.
Yeah,
I can give you one example. There's a culvert that goes under a road, and it was 7 feet tall because I'm 6 feet tall, and I can walk in it with a little bit of room. And the dam the beavers built was all the way to the top. There was very little sunlight coming through, and it was just completely plugged. So I go inside the pipe. I tear out the dam, takes about an hour, hour and a half, start disassembling. I tear it out, but I tear it completely down. The next morning, it was right back up.
Wow.
One beaver did all that in one night.
Sheesh.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, tell me, just so I know the next time I'm riding a bike and a beaver is kind of waterlocking me, how do you tear down a beaver dam?
The way that I describe it is I disassemble it. So I go downstream and I'm looking for the sticks that are easy to remove. I get all the way down to the bottom, all the way downstream of it, and I'm looking for the sticks. And I just start pulling sticks out and throw them to the side, pulling sticks out, throw them to the side until I get an area that's 2 to 3 feet. I'm not trying to go bank to bank. I just want to get the water to drop. So I want a 2 to 3 foot wide hole, right? So I'm just pulling out as many sticks as I can in that 2 to 3 foot wide hole until I have a vertical wall of mud.
Hmm.
When I do that, I take what I call my Joe Biden backhoe, because that's the only piece of equipment they give me. It's a potato rake. Okay, picture a pitchfork that's turned 90 degrees.
All right.
So you have five really strong prongs, but they're turned 90 degrees. And then you take that and dig and pull, and you just throw it in the mud and pull. And once you get that backside gone and you get a hole, that water is coming through there so fast that the water is now eroding.
Oh, God.
And if you do it right, as I've told many people I've trained, you let the water do 80% of the work. You got to get out of the way of it because the water is coming so fast, it'll flush you downstream.
Wow.
That's some serious water pressure that's up against it. So as you crack it and get the water flowing, then you move to the side and start making it wider and deeper until that water is just ripping so hard it's eroding it out.
Well, I think that's the problem we did is that we were upstream. We were upstream and just couldn't. So we should have gone around to the other side of the dam and gone from there. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and even there, then we wouldn't have been standing in our waist, water up to our waist. So we would have had it lower. So, okay, gosh, duh, this is good. I find it fascinating that all of God's creatures share some things in common, and I would call us a creature because we're created by God. And the beavers, they're probably not fighting aging as much as we are, you know? Us, everything's a quote-unquote young man's game. You want them young. You want the energy, the enthusiasm. Every brand that's out there is always trying to attract younger consumers who aren't set in their purchasing habits and all that stuff. And all that leads to us deifying youth and not being around older people who actually are smarter and better than us. That's what I'm hearing from you with the beaver stuff. Anything more you want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's one of the longest lived animals in the animal kingdom, especially in North America. I mean, very few animals live beyond 7 to 10 years in the animal kingdom. You'll have some of the wolves can get up to about 12, 13 years, and not talking about birds, because birds can live decades, especially the waterfowl can live decades. But as far as, you know, it's a rodent. A beaver's a rodent. It's the largest rodent in North America. Mm. And the teeth continue to grow throughout their life, which is another reason that they have to chew to keep the teeth from eating down. And the way that they overlap and come together creates a very sharp, which is how they can chew trees down so quickly and so efficiently. And, you know, they're cutting the trees to get to the top. The smaller limbs are easier to eat, easier to chew, easier to manipulate than the big trunk of the tree is. Right? They cut the tree down to get to the top, and most of the time they're really good at felling it into the water. And then they can chew off all the little branches and all that kind of stuff. And then once they get through it, they go and put it in the dam. I know, it's really amazing that this rodent can do all this. It really is. It's really amazing that the rodent can do all this. But so my job with the USDA in beaver trapping is to protect the roadways from flooding and also to protect agricultural fields and any cash crop that's being impacted in a negative way for beavers. And so the listeners understand this, Brian, it is nationwide in every state is illegal to relocate beavers. Huh. You're taking the problem from John's property and putting it over on Bill's property. So when we remove beavers, then they are dispatched during the process. Yeah.
How big of a tree can they chop down?
As big as you can imagine.
Really?
Yeah. I've seen here, we don't have old growth trees where I live, but you're talking trees that are, I'd say the biggest I've seen would be I'm trying to think, circumference of 3.5 feet.
Huh. Wow.
It takes them a while. They don't like to chew those big trees because the smaller ones are quicker and easier to get. I'd say the average size tree that they eat is maybe 4 inches.
Okay. We were on a trip. I was on a trip with my son once, and we were in the woods, and there was a tree that was, probably maybe a foot across, 10 inches across. It was so funny. It was obvious that a beaver had started on this tree, and then for whatever reason, he decided not to take it down. But we were just laughing because, you talk about beavers always have to be busy, in large part because they don't want those teeth growing down around their chin and kind of keeping their mouth shut. The beaver's going, got to be busy. I must eat something. Let's go chaw on that thing over there. They are always busy, go nonstop creatures, aren't they?
They are.
And you said there's no
hardwired
predators.
To build dams and to do that stuff. And as far as predators go, I mean, black bears will get them if they can. They usually tear the lodges apart to get down to them. That's what they do. If a coyote or any of those major predators catches them on the bank, they will eat them, but they're not hunted by any natural predator whatsoever. And a lot of that's because of their size and where they live. They live in the water.
Right.
They'll basically eat the bank away, and then they'll keep going further as the trees get further from the bank. They will move in, but they don't go far. They don't walk really well because they're not made to. They're made to swim.
So there's not that many bears, fortunately or unfortunately. Are you saying, like, throughout American history, like hundreds and hundreds of years ago, the beavers didn't have predators, or have we killed off some of the predators and their population's flourishing right now?
They've never had it. If you go back in history to when America got expanded, it was the fur trapper that expanded the West and North in United States and in Canada. And the documentation shows that the reason the fur trappers went was for beaver pelts. And there's some journals that were kept by some of the trappers that talk about the beaver are as thick as the mosquitoes.
Really?
And they were catching beavers by the tens of thousands, and we still have them. It's kind of like wild pigs or roaches. You can't seem to get rid of them if you want to. They just continue to keep coming and keep coming, which is a good thing. It's a good thing.
I was reading a book, going through a book right now on Jacob Astor. One of the huge, massive wealth families of America made their money from trapping. That was how he did it, was all trapping. And yet there's hardly anybody trapping, and a lot of states have outlawed trapping entirely, right?
There's a few that have it entirely, but most of them have some form of trapping that's legal, but the method in which you're able to do it varies from state to state. As an example, beavers, otters, muskrats.
Yep.
That's what you're trapping as far as water trapping. And every state's different in that. Some states, like in South Carolina, our trapping season is December 1 to March 1. It's typically a winter activity, a deep winter activity. And that's because that's when the fur is the thickest.
Wow.
and you're trapping for the fur. A fur trapper's trapping for the fur, and if you catch a July coyote versus a December or January coyote, the fur is going to be 4 to 5 inches difference in thickness. So it makes a significant difference. So it's a wintertime activity. And in South Carolina, our laws are we can only use specific types of traps and specific sizes of traps for those animals. Whereas in other states, it could be different. So if you listen to this, you really need to check your rules and regulations of your state because they can be very, very different. Land trapping, we have what's the traditional known as the foothold. You know, the one that clamps on the foot and holds them. There's no teeth on these things anymore. Haven't been in 100 years. They're smooth jawed. They're designed to capture and hold, but not to harm. So it just holds them on the foot. Basically, on a coyote, as an example, anything with a pad, it catches them above the pad so they can't pull their foot out. Mm. That's all it does. Yeah. Doesn't break the skin, doesn't break the bone. It just holds them until you can get there and catch them. And decide what you're going to do with them. And some people, well, I won't even get into all that. But
Please, why not? Part of why people listen to The Aggressive Life is to hear things they normally don't hear. And that's part of why I like having people on. So, yeah, so we don't talk about this much, and I don't know much about it either. So please educate me.
Okay, so things like here in the South, coyotes and foxes, we can sell them alive or we can dispatch them and sell the fur. So there's like high fence enclosures for training dogs to chase fox, coyotes, raccoons, and things of that nature. And by being in a fence, you can control what the dogs are doing. So these running pens is what they're called, where the dogs are running these animals and chasing them. Now, so the listener doesn't go crazy and say, oh, those poor things. You have to build it to a specific standard. Okay, and you have to provide escape places for these animals to go. Hmm. So typically what people do is take old refrigerators and they put big holes in the end of it so the fox and coyote can go inside there and make a little den and get away from the dogs.
Huh. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. So there's plenty of ways for the, because if you're training your dog, you don't want it to catch it. You're teaching it to chase, not to catch.
Yeah.
But then there's the fur market, and then there's the live market for coyotes, foxes here in the Southeast. Beyond that, it's strictly fur trapping, and in which you're catching the animal in order to sell its fur. And it's also population control. As a dedicated turkey hunter, I love hunting turkeys. I know that raccoons, possums, and skunks are the number one threat to turkey populations. They're what's known as nest predators. For any birds that nest on the ground, think of a raccoon wandering along and it finds a nest of 14 turkey eggs. What's it going to do? Hmm. It's a bundle of protein right there. And when the people in the South have pretty much stopped hunting raccoons, there is overpopulation of raccoons in the Midwest and the South. I mean, an enormous amount. I know guys who catch 1,000 raccoons every year in the same places every year. They're trapping the same streams, the same farms every year, and they're catching over 1,000 raccoons, which shows you're not hurting the population.
Right. What are they doing with 1,000 pelts? Is there a market for that?
Yes, yes. The National Fur Traders Association is a buying house, right? And the people that buy fur, you know, the ones that end up making garments out of them or blankets or whatever, the people that buy fur go to these auction houses. So a fur trapper would take all of his fur once it's put up, as we call it, you know, skinned, flesh, dried, and ready to ship. And we ship it to the National Fur Buyers Association, National Fur Trappers Association. And the buyers come there and they buy them. They actually, it's like a tobacco auction, bidding on each individual fur based on its quality and size. And species.
I know I can hear some of our listeners going, man, I'm just not into the whole hunting thing. I don't understand it. Why don't we just like live and let live, let these animals do their thing, let nature take its natural course. What's the argument for why we should allow managed hunting and trapping? What would happen to parts of our country if we just said everybody hands off and all you can eat is vegetables or cows that are brought up on a ranch?
Yeah. Well, if you just do a little bit of history reading, Ryan, and you'll see that at the turn of the 1900s, White-tailed deer was almost extinct. Elk was extinct in most of its old range. The pronghorn antelope was on the verge of extinction. And we can go on and on with all these species because there was this uncontrolled demand for deer skins and venison to feed the restaurants in the East. So professional hunters went out and just killed as many as they could. Same thing with the waterfowl. They were providing fresh ducks. So we had these giant punt guns, which were like 2-gauge and 4-gauge, that would shoot these enormous amounts of shot and killing 50, 60 ducks at a time. And what the hunters saw was, we're going to put ourselves out of business. We need to start regulating these animals. So hunters in the early 1900s got together and said, really the late 1800s, the Boone and Crockett Club was the first ones to do it, to recognize that we need to start managing these wildlife for future generations. And so hunters are the ones who petitioned state agencies and federal agencies to put limits on how many animals you could kill of a specific species. We're also the ones who put a season on it. You can't hunt them year-round anymore. You can only hunt them between October 1 and January 1. That's it, and you can only kill 5. We're the ones that did that. And then on top of that, in 1932, I think it was, we pushed Congress, we being the hunters and anglers of the world, to tax ourselves. We passed the Pittman-Robertson Act, which puts an 11% tax on everything we buy for hunting and fishing. If I buy bullets, there's an 11% tax on that. If I buy a firearm, if I buy camouflage clothes.
Interesting. Above and beyond the normal state tax, huh?
Everything else. Yep. It's called the Pittman-Robertson Act, and it's an 11% tax that we put on ourselves. And what's important about that is that that's a federal tax, but that money is sent back to the states, and it can only be used for wildlife conservation efforts. Hmm. But by putting that tax on ourselves, we have saved white-tailed deer. We have saved mule deer. We have saved the pronghorn antelope. We have saved the elk. Not only that, we have reintroduced them into places where they were extinct. We've taken deer from places where the population grew and reintroduced them in places where they were extinct because hunters saw the need to preserve these animals. If we had just said, no more hunting, then there wouldn't have been the money, and money drives everything, Brian, you know that, or the effort put in to try to save these species. So that's why we do it.
But what about on the other side? Because someone would say, well, it's fine that we're limiting the number of deer that can be killed and we're paying for it, but what if we just eliminated all of that? What if we just like, sorry, we don't need to hunt anymore. You can buy stuff in the grocery store. We don't need to, we're just let the animal populations do what they naturally do. What's the downside of that?
All right. What's the downside of that is I work for the USDA, right?
Yeah.
And we have projects, you'll see it on the news, where government snipers have gone in to remove these animals off of the airfield so the airplanes aren't crashing into geese and ducks and deer when they're trying to land. Yeah. All right. Everybody wants to protect the animals until they affect them. Seriously.
Yeah.
As an example, there's a neighborhood here in South Carolina, I can't say where or what, but it's a gated neighborhood that has, it's about a 5-square-mile area, right? And there are 1,200 plus deer on that 5 square miles. Now, the carrying capacity of the land in South Carolina is about 15 deer per square mile. Okay. They have 1,200 deer in 5 miles. They're eating themselves out of house and home. They're starving to death.
Yes.
So do you want the animals to die a horrific starvation death? I can tell you, you don't. You're talking about bad press. Why are we letting these animals starve to death? Now people are going to bring food to them. But Bill and Sue over here, they're tired of the deer eating their pansies they put out.
Hey, amen. I'm tired of eating my arborvitae. Oh, my gosh. They just crush it every freaking year. I just dealt with it yesterday, trying to put more repellent down. It doesn't repel anything.
No. Yes. I got to have an 8-foot-tall fence around my vegetable garden to keep the deer from eating it. Yeah, right. They reach a population that the land can't sustain. then you start getting very tragic things. You get disease, you get starvation, you get inbreeding that's uncontrollable, and you get a lot of car and deer collisions,
yep.
Right? And again, I've heard it so many times in my career, Brian, we need to save the animals until your kid gets killed by hitting a deer in his car. And Now let's kill them all.
Right.
So if humans are going to live with animals, we have to regulate the number of animals.
Right. Yeah. I never hunted before. And then I hit a deer going 80 miles an hour on my motorcycle without a helmet on. It's another story.
That's a bad day.
Yeah. Well, it was a miraculous day for me, actually. God miraculously saved my life. Flew in the air as I tried to figure out. It looked like I was thrown in the air. I don't know, 30, 40, 50, 60 yards, whatever it was. I think it was I threw in the air 60 yards as we clocked it out, and then rolled on the concrete or on the blacktop another 40 yards. And actually, I had bad braking technique. When I just jammed on my back brake and didn't use front brake, my truck or my bike, not mine, the one I rented, the back end fishtailed.
At least it wasn't yours.
Right, exactly. And at least I bought the insurance too. The back end fishtailed. So I kind of hit the deer as the bike was fishtailing. So therefore, when I went over the handlebars, I didn't go face first, or else I would have literally broken in half. I landed perfectly on my side and then rolled all the way down the highway for all that time. And it was a miracle of God. People say, oh, you should have worn a helmet. I said, no, I should have worn gloves because I got 5 stitches and 2 knuckles. That's the only thing I had was that. Anyway, I just thought, no, every deer needs to die. They need to die, which is a bit of an overreaction. And it's one of the reasons I hunt is to hold down the population. It's a serious thing.
Right. It is.
Flying K Ranch. Today's episode is brought to you by them because I believe they're producing some of the most mouth-watering, healthy burgers, steaks, roasts I've ever had. They're in Findlay, Ohio. Flying K raises their beef with no hormones or antibiotics, so you know you're getting the most natural product. It's a family business, partnering with state and national certification boards to ensure both cattle and customers are happy. You can find out more, place your orders at Flying K. KRanchAngus.com. That's Flying KRanchAngus.com. I'm liking it a lot. It's always fun for me to talk hunting with somebody here in the podcast because I don't know many other people who hunt. I mean, my friends have gotten into hunting in large part because I've wooed them into hunting, but I never get to have hunting conversations because, you know, in the urban areas of Cincinnati or of Ohio, just no one hunts anymore. It doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's a shame too.
Yeah. So how did you get into hunting and trapping or trapping? What was your first trap? What was the first beaver you got?
Oh, my first beaver. I was an adult before I started trapping beavers.
All right. But good. It's good not to start too young.
Yeah. My dad was not a outdoorsman at all. I just took it up myself. I don't know. I just always had a draw to the woods, Brian. I've just always have been. And when I didn't have a mentor, I started reading Daniel Boone and John Muir and all the frontiersmen and the mountain men who the trappers of the old days. I started reading everything about them. And then I started subscribing to Outdoor Life and Sports Field and reading all these stories that these guys wrote about hunting. And it just enthralled me. And at 14, I told my parents, I said, I want a .22 rifle for my birthday. And they're like, why you want a gun for? I said, cause I want to go hunting squirrels. That's the only thing I knew where I lived. And I did, I got one. I got a Sears and Roebuck .22 rifle. With a scope on it. I thought I was big time with that little scope on it. It was semi-automatic, and I started just on my own trying to figure out how to do it. And I was hooked from the very first one I was able to get. I've been hooked ever since. I still really enjoy squirrel hunting. It's one of my favorite things to do. Yeah, it really is. It's just, you know, it's not a – I think small game hunting is very overlooked as to me – it's the best way to introduce people to the sport for a couple reasons. There's a high success rate, number one. You don't have big recoil on guns. You know, a lot of new hunters are scared of the noise and the recoil of a big gun. So you're shooting 410s or 20 gauge shotguns and 22 rifles. So light guns, low noise, easy to shoot. You have success. You don't have to be quiet. You can ease through the woods. Huh. I do a lot of the hunting for squirrels with pellet rifles now. These Gammo Swarm pellet rifles are really good for squirrels.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, 22 caliber. Yeah.
I have never considered squirrel hunting. So, yeah, okay, I'm thinking like maybe I could get my buddies into squirrel hunting because we could go up, shoot some squirrels, skin them, eat them, slam some beers, be a good day.
Yeah, yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. Is there squirrel season in most states or is just if you can get them, you get them?
Yeah, no, it's the squirrels. Now, some states is year-round, so you have to check with Ohio. I don't know about Ohio, but down here it's October 1 to March 1, and we can kill 10 a day. In South Carolina, if it's in your yard, you can shoot it year-round.
Really?
We have 300-foot radius around our yard that we can keep because squirrels are considered game animals, but they're also considered pests. So anything that's within your domain, you're allowed to take year-round.
And they taste good from what I understand too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Fascinating. So tell me how you went from USDA beaver trapper, even before I ask you this question, describe what the beaver trap is like. How do you trap a beaver?
Yeah, there's three primary methods. One's a snare, which is a cable made into a loop. The beaver swims through it. It tightens up around them and holds them, and then you have to dispatch them when you get there. Another one is called a body grip. So picture it's a metal square. I use the 10-inch. It's called a 330 size, and a lot of people use the name Conibear because Frank Conibear invented it, but it's technically a body grip trap. So it's a square with a trigger. The beaver swims through it, and it snaps in behind the neck, kind of like a rat trap does on a rat.
Okay.
It expands really, really fast and hits them and kills them. It'll break your arm. That's how strong the springs are. Wow. Okay, it's very strong. Think about how big the beavers are, right? That we talked about.
And it's doing that under the water or that's above the water?
Depending on the states, usually underwater because they swim into it.
Yep. Okay.
Yep. And then there's the foothold, which is the same type as you use on land, but for a beaver. And those are typically connected to either a cable or a steel rod. So the beaver steps, like say you tear a hole in the dam, you put a foothold there, he comes to repair it, he steps in it. And when he tries to swim away, he drowns.
Oh, that's sneaky. Yeah. So you destroy his property knowing he's going to fix it because he's a beaver. Beaver must be busy. And then you get him in the trap that you put there by the thing you've destroyed.
Easiest way to catch him is to tear a hole in his dam and put a trap in front of the hole. It's not hard.
Oh, my gosh. That is awesome. So then how did you go from trapping beaver to now you speak, you got a podcast? What was the evolution of that?
I've been an outdoor writer for Hunting and Fishing magazines for 25 years now, Brian. And as an outdoor writer, one of the things that I noticed by knowing so many people in the outdoor industry, whether they're TV personalities or other writers, and me being a person of faith who loves the outdoors, and I knew so many of these other people were persons of faith that were in the outdoors, but you can't publish your faith in outdoor life. They won't publish it. You can't talk about your faith openly on the Outdoor Channel or Sportsman's Network. They're a little bit better on that now, but when I started this, they were not. And so, it was just laid on my heart.
Just start right there. Stop right there for a minute. I'm surprised that you couldn't talk about your faith on those networks because generally the people who are in those kind of sports are good old boys and have a warm spot towards churches, God, country, all that stuff.
I know. Yeah, I know. But, it's driven by their advertising dollars, right? Advertising dollars say what you can say and what you can't say, right? So I was like, being an outdoor writer, communicator, content creator, whatever phrase you want to use nowadays, and the evolution of how content creation has changed from print magazines to digital magazines to blogs to blah, blah, blah. I saw podcasting as something on the horizon back in 2017. A lot of people were already doing it, but in the outdoor space, it was not quite as popular. So I said, well, I think I want to find a, create a spot where I can talk about the two things I'm most passionate about, Jesus and the outdoors. How can I do that? So after a little bit of soul searching, I came up with a very original title, Christian Outdoors. How about that for original? Creative,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Creative. Yeah, but it covers both. And so I started that is by saying, I want to talk about everything outdoors, or I think my little tagline is how, where we talk about all things outdoors and how to enjoy God every day. And that was my driving force. And I wrote the book, How to Enjoy God, that was kind of supporting that. And so I started with just general interviewing people who are my friends, the outdoor industry, and said, I need guest. And we would talk about something that they do, you know, if it's a TV personality in the outdoors, you know, how did you get involved in hunting on TV? How long have you been doing it? And they would tell their story. And then I asked them to share their faith story as well. I don't call it a testimony, Brian, because I want to start from before you got saved, getting saved, and now how's it impacting you, the whole faith story. And we usually start with a simple question. Did you grow up in church? And if it's a yes, then that takes you down one path. If it's a no, because I didn't grow up in church, it takes you down another path, and you get the whole story. And so our episodes are a combination of what do you do in the outdoors, and how does Jesus affect your life before, during, and now, and in the future? How does all that work together? And it's been doing really well. It really has. We also have episodes where I have two pastor friends of mine, one Baptist, one non-nom, and we get together and talk about theological issues. We'll come together and we'll say, let's talk about the sacraments. Why do the Catholics have seven sacraments? We have two. And what's the difference in a sacrament and an ordinance? And we just break that down so the listeners can understand stuff like that.
So all seven of your listeners on that podcast, they like to hear that stuff.
You know what's surprising?
Yeah, that's what.
You know what's surprising?
Yeah, what?
This is what's surprising to me. I thought those would be the lowest listened shows, but they're up there at the top.
Fascinating.
The ones where we're talking about theological issues are some of the most listened to episodes.
Huh, interesting.
And I'm going to give you a little teaser here. I am in the process of producing bonus episodes that are going to come out in midweek, because I release a show every Monday and have since I started. So we're at 221 episodes now, just one a week. But I'm going to start doing bonus episodes of Bible talk, whether it's a topic that we're talking about, you know, 15 minutes, 15 to 20 minute episodes. It's going to be bonus episodes. It's going to be strictly focused on teaching things. And I'm going to start by going through my book, How to Enjoy God Every Day.
Cool.
And then we're going to go into being godly men. You and I share that passion, the five marks of a man, and my thing too. We share that, how to help men become better. So that's going to be starting in the very near future.
That's great.
Very near future.
That's great, Pete. Well, Pete, I'm loving that people are learning a bit about you, story, loving that people are understanding more of Beavers. You've given a little bit of your insight as far, in terms of how someone can find you or your content. Just close us out with that. Like, how does somebody find you, or where do they go?
Okay, christianoutdoors.org is my website. Every one of my podcast episodes are there. There's an about me there. There's our faith statement is on that page. If you want me to come speak at your event, you can go there and see where I'm speaking. I don't think I'm going to be in the Cincinnati area anytime soon. I'll be in close to Memphis this Saturday and then up in Buffalo the weekend after that at three different places. But if you can go there if you want me to come speak at your event and see that. So everything is on my website at christianoutdoors.org. On the podcast, it's Christian Outdoors Podcast. On all the podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, Google Play, it's on every one of them. And the YouTube channel is Christian Outdoors as well. So I'm now videoing my podcast and putting it on YouTube as well.
Hey, this has been great. You know, I didn't want to just introduce people to the idea of beaver management, but I knew there was going to be stuff here that was going to apply to our lives. And so there's something here for somebody, I'm telling you. Is it that you're too lazy and you be a little more like a beaver, be a busy beaver? Is it that you are younger and you're not hanging around with older people to get some of their wisdom and how they actually operate? What is it? What is it that you may need to do to push your life to the next level and become a productive little working beaver? I hope you got something. It's been great having my friend on The Aggressive Life. We'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life. Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and live events over at briantome.com. My new books, a repackaged edition of The 5 Marks of a Man and a brand new 5 Marks of a Man tactical guide are open right now on Amazon. If you haven't yet, leave this podcast a rating and review. It really helps get the show in front of new listeners. And if you want to connect, find me on Instagram at Brian Tome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.